Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Whether you are married or not, part of a couple or not, you probably have some opinion on the subject of relationships. You've probably met other couples whose relationship you admire or might want to emulate. Almost certainly you've known a couple whose relationship is so utterly unappealing as to be incomprehensible to you. And no doubt, you have a thought or two about what is good or bad about your own relationship. But what is the basis of these judgments? We learn something about love and marriage from our parents, from the experiences of friends and family members, maybe even from love stories, songs, or poetry. But do we have a coherent way of thinking about coupledom? And if we do, where did it come from? Today on Odyssey, we are going to take a look at our contemporary conception of relationships. What are its implications about the way for the way we experience love or marriage or the failure of these things? Joining us for the conversation is David Shumway. He is the author of Modern Love, Intimacy, Romance, and the Marriage Crisis. He joins us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. With us here in Chicago is cultural critic Laura Kipnis. She is the author of Against Love, A Polemic. David Shumway there in Pittsburgh, let me ask you to get us started. What are some of the ideas that you see out there shaping the way we think about or form expectations about love and marriage?
Well, there are two, and they are to some extent in competition and to some extent work complementary with each other. The first of them is romance. And what I mean by romance are stories that people both read or watch, but also which they plan out their lives, that begin with a fall into love, continue with the overcoming of obstacles to that love, and end, in one version, the tragic version, with death. That's the more traditional one, or the more recent one, the fairy tale version, in marriage. The other set of ideas I call intimacy, and here we have love conceived as something that happens between lovers, and over which they may assert some control. Intimacy takes the relationship, a new term proper to it as its focus, and thus displaces traditional terms like courtship and marriage. Its utopia is emotional closeness and equality between partners.
And intimacy is, in some sense, something that is invoked or comes into play after the pairing has already taken place. In other words, you have the partner, you found them.
That's right.
Now romance, we're in a terrain of intimacy.
Romance can't really talk about what happens after the pairing. Intimacy talks about almost nothing else.
All right. We're going to dig into some of the other implications or entailments of those two ideas. But Laura Kipnis, you've got some other observations about ideas that are out there that are shaping the way we think about love. Well, what do you see out there?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about this whole conglomeration of ideas and norms, you know, that David talks about, is that they don't seem to be working. The most interesting thing that's going on, I think, these days about love and intimacy and couples and marriage is the immense amount of dissatisfaction surrounding these things. There's a statistic that comes out of the Rutgers University Marriage Project that something like only 38% of people who are in marriages these days say that they're happy in that condition. So whatever these norms and expectations and ideas about love are, they're just creating dissatisfaction. They don't seem to be working.
But are there particular ideas that you think are there any ideas that you see competing with the ones that David Shumway has laid out?
Well, the mantra of modern relationships, and it's in every relationship advice book you pick up, is this slogan, good relationships take work, good marriages take work. So I think what David didn't mention is the work ethic of love, this idea that you have to work at it, and if it's not working, you have to work harder because you haven't worked hard enough. And, you know, I think at some level, people are just going on strike. Who wants to work that hard?
David Shumway, what's your reaction to Laura's comments, first of all?
Well, the idea that we have to work on our relationships is a fairly recent one, and it is part of the discourse of intimacy. I mean, I would trace it to about the 1970s. But I would also say that we need to keep in mind that not all work is alienated labor. Work is not necessarily in itself bad, and it can seem that way if it's taken in the wrong way. It may also, however, be an unfortunate choice of phrase. I mean, I suspect that the phrase got started because Americans have trouble conceiving of anything important if we don't call it work.
That's an interesting thought. Let's back up a little bit, though, because I want to sort of look at origins of these things. Well, first of all, I want to outline where it is that you see these ideas coming from. Laura Kipnis, you were just mentioning advice manuals and advice columns that talk about here's how you work on your relationship. Are there other sources for this idea that you think are important where you see this rhetoric being thrown at us?
Well, there are endless sources. I mean, every time you turn on the TV and watch some domestic sitcom or within, you know, love stories in movies or in literature, you know, I think it's all at some level advice culture. You know, there's a set of norms being propagated. These are ideals to live up to, or these are fantasies that your life should, you know, emulate. So, I think we're just kind of surrounded by messages about love at every moment.
David Shumway, you think that's true? Where do you see these messages coming from?
Well, the discourse of romance is very old. Romantic ideas get their start in the Middle Ages, and they were at that point a protest against the officially sanctioned marriages of the aristocracy. And romance was very much opposed to marriage for hundreds of years in the literary works and other instances where it was present. In the 19th century, as people increasingly choose their own partners, and individualism increases, romance gets to be grafted onto marriage, and people expect to have to fall into love and then get married. And that's, of course, the pattern that most of us take to be familiar. Intimacy is much more recent. It's a post-World War II phenomenon and really doesn't become popular until the 70s. And its sources are, I would agree with Laura, advice literature, although before that, the family therapy movement is a point of origin. I would also mention second wave feminism and movies like Woody Allen's Annie Hall in Manhattan, books like John Updike's Couples, all of which show how relationships work in one way or another.
In contrast to something we might have seen before? I mean, there have been love stories before that, certainly.
Yes, but those typically dealt with courtship, that is, how we get to marriage, how we get to sex. Romance typically either dealt with adultery or postponed kind of metaphorical sex to the wedding at the end. Of course, under intimacy, sex is part of courtship, as it were. People have sex before they get married, before they become fully coupled. And that's part of what these works of all kinds talk about.
One thing to just add is about these competing models and the ways that they're in conflict with each other is that, you know, we're accustomed to thinking about having free choice in marriage, that there was a shift from arranged marriages and marriage as an economic institution to one based in romance and intimacy. But, you know, listen, we all know people still pick mates on the basis of pragmatics and economic considerations are not absent from it. And one of the an interesting point that Eva Luz makes in her book *Consuming the Romantic Utopia* is that the pragmatic financial aspect of mate selection has just been incorporated into the psychology of love. So it's internalized now. Instead of having your parents pick out the best mate for you, you know, you do it yourself. But call it something like chemistry or call it clicking. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the process of, you know, intimacy and mate formation that's not discussed openly, but is still tacit and, you know, kind of lies beneath the surface. And I think that's one of the reasons that there's so much strife and dissatisfaction is a lot of the stuff just isn't talked about openly.
Well, when you say that, do you mean that the clicking that happens, even if we understand it to be sort of spontaneous and romantic or whatever, we've internalized rules such that we make sure we don't click with someone who, let's say, isn't a good breadwinner or isn't a good enough breadwinner or whatever other pragmatic quality you may be looking for.
Well, doesn't everybody at some level know where they are on the open market of mate selection and tries to make the most advantageous selection and do, you know, the best that you can? No, I think it's pretty unusual to marry down. So I think everybody's, you know, whether the qualities that you're looking for are financial or physical or social standing, you know, all of those kind of issues enter into mate selection.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Our conversation today is about modern love, specifically the modern conception of relationships, the ideas we have about love and marriage, what it's supposed to be like, how we're supposed to get to it, and what sorts of consequences might flow from the ideas that we hold. Let's think some more then about what effects these ideas have. Okay, so you have a romance model of love. You have an intimacy model of love. David Shemmel, you were saying that in some ways these two ideas conflict. What's the conflict?
Well, romance wants you to have the experience of infatuation. That's what it privileges. And so a romantic model basically says that if you're not in the throes of passion, something's going wrong. And that really is, I think, incompatible with a long-term relationship. It's not that I think continued good sex isn't possible, but I think the intensity of that initial fall into love is not something most people, if anybody, really sustains. And since romance makes that the definition of love, it's a standard that no one can live up to.
It's not merely that the two things are seen as sequential, like you have the romance and then you have the intimacy part of love, or is that, I mean, people talk the way, but is that just an attempt to reconcile the conflict?
That's how intimacy sees it. Intimacy sees this moment of infatuation or romance followed by the need to develop a deeper, more mature relationship. But I don't think a lot of people in our culture understand that connection, and I believe actually that the state of modern love is confused because people's experience are shaped by these ways of thinking in ways that they don't entirely understand. Take personal ads, for example. People place personal ads, it seems to me, because they have a fantasy about wanting to fall in love with a stranger, but the ads themselves often reflect something that's almost the opposite, these ideas come from intimacy. They want a best friend, a soulmate, someone with very common interests, and there doesn't seem to be the recognition of a contradiction between looking for someone you've never met before and someone that you want to know really well.
That's an interesting conflict. We'll talk some more about that idea. I'm sort of working it out in my noodle at the moment. But you know what? I'll do that during a break. And when we come back, we'll talk some more about the effects of some of these ideas on marriage and love and some of the questions they raise about the way we organize these relationships in our society. Stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Our Sunday night series of radio theater concludes this weekend with Luis Valdez's Zoot Suit. Chicano playwright Valdez uses the Sleepy Lagoon murder case to examine the Zoot Suit culture of the 40s and the racial tensions that turned to violence in L.A. Sunday evening from 5 to 7 on Chicago Public Radio. Chicago Public Radio is supported by the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, with master's and doctoral programs offered at the downtown Chicago campus. An open house session will be held October 4th. Registration is at 312-322-3150 or online at csopp.edu. Thank you. You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and our topic today is modern love, the modern conception of the relationship of love and marriage, what it's about, what it's supposed to feel like, why we do it. We're talking today with David Shumway, who is on the faculty in the English department at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's the author of Modern Love, so of course he knows, Modern Love, Romance, Intimacy, and the Marriage Crisis. And he's joining us from Pittsburgh. With us here in Chicago is Laura Kipnis. She is a cultural critic, and she teaches media studies at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Her new book is called Against Love, A Polemic. Laura Kipnis, let's talk a little bit more about marriage under these particular conditions. You mentioned before that these conventions that we have are not working. In light of what's been said, let me ask you to be a little more specific about that. What is particularly, what does it mean for it not to work?
Okay. One thing to say is I am talking about coupledom in general because, you know, I think especially with the move toward gay marriage, you know, which is not state-sanctioned marriage, I'm saying that kind of all long-term couples or couples who pledge monogamy are, you know, sort of in the state of marriage, whether it's official marriage or not. I mean, you know, going back to the dissatisfaction and the high divorce rate, so, you know, that seems to me the evidence of it not working. I also use adultery as some kind of evidence of the ways in which people in these very private ways are searching, you know, questing for something else, trying to find other forms or invent other ways to have a love life. And I talk a lot about the kind of policing and rulemaking that goes on in couples, that this is what the norm of intimacy is these days, particularly within domestic couples. It seems like the opportunity to boss someone around and formulate endless strictures and expectations and, you know, micro scrutinies of other people's behavior, whether it's, you know, their table manners or the way they dress. So, you know, there's something about the texture of daily intimacy that has gotten so police-like that, and I think that it's so taken for granted and so little discussed except at the level of, say, stand-up comedy, you know, or those anti-sitcoms like Married with Children. So, you know, dissatisfaction, I think it's expressed in these larger ways, but if you look on the ground at the texture of, you know, coupled life, there's something oftentimes very oppressive about it.
David Shumway, what do you think about that? Well, first of all, do you think that that's a natural consequence of the idea of intimacy?
No. I think intimacy can breed that. And I talk about intimacy as a kind of technology of the soul, which, borrowing from the French philosopher Michel Foucault's notion of discipline, it's a way in which we self-regulate, and I think Laura's right, to some extent regulate each other. But I don't think that's all that's involved. The discourse, I think, also genuinely makes us aware of the significance of human attachment as an important aspect of our lives. Attachment being that form of emotional bond that we all learn as children from our relationship with our parents, that's really, I think, kind of at the basic root of human social life. And so I see this discourse as having potentially quite positive benefits, but also risks. It's not either entirely, you know, good or bad.
What, say a little bit more about the benefits. I think Laura's outlined some of the risks pretty clearly.
Well, I guess I would respond to Laura directly by saying, why do people keep doing it if it's so bad? It seems to me that there's no question that a lot of people are dissatisfied with their relationships, and yet most people who get divorced remarry, or they form other long-term relationships. It seems to me that although there are people, I would happily concede, who are better off not married, and it's a mistake for society to make marriage an expectation of everybody. But it's clearly something that many, many people desire. And what intimacy as a discourse, I think, does in fact help people to understand is the emotional benefits of these long-term relationships, as opposed to the other kinds of benefits of passion, of the short-term infatuation.
Laura Kipnis, go right ahead.
Some of the psychoanalytic theories of attachment are interesting on this, because part of the premise would be that there's a quest for something that in the end is somehow impossible. You know, you talked about the kind of initiation of this in childhood and the model for attachment being some kind of early affective relationship, the mother-child bond. But, you know, is the attempt to reproduce that or repair it in later life at some level doomed to fail? So one thing you could say at a, you know, psychoanalytic level is that there's something impossible about this quest in the first place. And so part of the what happens within relationships and the dissatisfaction is some recognition psychologically about being after something that's sort of impossible, some need that at some level just isn't ever going to be met. And so people enact this kind of thing within relationships. I mean, it's a sort of pessimistic view. But, you know, that may be at the root of it.
Well, let me ask you to respond to David's point. If we think just about remarriage, lots of people who get divorced remarry. They've had the experience. They have some, it's not just a marriage is no longer just an idea or hypothetical for them. They've had a marriage. If it's a bad deal, they should in theory know. So what do you think accounts for the high rate of remarriage and the desire of people to re-enter these relationships?
Optimism.
Really?
Yeah, I think people, you know, optimism, some kind of, I mean, clearly quest, need for intimacy and connection. I mean, I wouldn't dispute that. Part of the question, though, is whether the terms that were handed, the contemporary expectations of intimacy and the ways in which, you know, you want this other person to be everything to you, you know, whether that is possible. But, you know, at some level, it's also the only game in town. So people make it work and adapt, or they produce their own private deals, like they find other kinds of satisfaction on the side through adultery or, you know, serial relationships, serial monogamy.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about adultery, because you have a particular take on adultery in your new book. It's not, I wouldn't say that it's pro-adultery, but it certainly contemplates the pro-adultery position. Let's put it that way.
It's trying to reframe the question of adultery and take some of the moralism out of it. You know, adultery is an interesting form. It's trying to, you know, in some kind of interesting experimental way, find other forms of connection beside the normal ones or the socially approved ones. And, you know, as we saw throughout the 90s, when it seemed like all of our politicians were, you know, performing this drama of marital dissatisfaction for us on the national stage, you know, it's a pretty endemic issue, problem, form, yet every time someone else is discovered in adultery, everyone feigns surprise. And then, you know, someone else is discovered and we all feign surprise again. It's, you know, it's the biggest social open secret.
David Shumway, it was interesting to me when you were talking about the origins of romance, that you were saying that romance originated as a concept in opposition to marriage, that it was outside of marriage. So, you know, I wonder if to some extent the whole idea of adultery isn't an attempt to sort of, you know, it's unsurprising if we have this romance-based idea of marriage.
I think it's utterly unsurprising, and I agree completely with Laura that it's astonishing that people keep pretending to be surprised every time some public figure is caught out. The problem, though, with sort of licensing adultery, I think, is the ethical problem involved. The original moral justification was, of course, entailed the fact that only heterosexual marriage could be a licensed, it was the only licensed form of sexual activity. Now, the society is at least on its way to licensing many other kinds, but adultery apparently is not one of them. And I suspect that that's because there really is this serious question of it always involving lying, of deceiving someone else, and deceiving someone who is emotionally vulnerable because of the character of the relationship. It's seldom a white lie.
Well, hang on, because I want to take a break and give people our phone number and let them know that they can join in our conversation about modern love by calling 1-888 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. That's the number to call. It is toll-free anywhere in the U.S. So join us if you would like to ask a question or make a comment. We're talking today about our conceptions of love and relationships. We're joined by David Shumway, who is the author of Modern Love, Romance, Intimacy, and the Marriage Crisis. He's joining us from Pittsburgh. And here in Chicago, we're talking with Laura Kipnis, who is the author of Against Love, a Polemic. Laura Kipnis, let me come back to you and ask you to be specific about what you think is going on in adultery. In other words, what is the motivation for so many people to break their vows?
Well, I want to say something about the ethical question. The other side of it is, what if the kind of norms and expectations and rules of intimacy are themselves deceptive? So the question, you know, of ethics always gets turned back on the individuals, but what if the institution itself at some level isn't upholding its vows, or the institution is deceptive in the kinds of promises that it holds out?
What do you mean? What would that be like?
Well, the promise, you know, the contract is that you renounce, you know, satisfying desires elsewhere, because within this framework of the couple or marital fidelity, couple fidelity, you're going to be satisfied in some way. So it's a contract, and it's a, you know, it's kind of the basis of the social contract, that coupledom and stability will meet your needs.
Let me ask you to specify here, not just a contract between partners, like I will meet your needs, but in a bigger sense, this institution will meet my needs.
Well, listen, all of the morality directed at people that stray or that break their marital vows is, you know, this language of the social fabric gets invoked. You're hurting society if you break your vows. So the vows are not just to another person, they're also to the institution, which at some level is seen as central to, you know, something like social stability.
David Shumway?
I actually think that's increasingly less true, though, that discourse, that talk is still around. But it seems to me that it doesn't make sense to assert that the institution of marriage can be binding in that way anymore, when it is so easy to leave it. That is, why choose to stay in the marriage and lie to your partner rather than just get out of the marriage and do something else? I mean, in an earlier period, when divorce was either illegal or forbidden by strong convention, then I think there was a better case for adultery as a kind of necessary or even ennobling act, as it becomes in some literature. But today, that it doesn't seem to hold water.
I still think that there's a huge amount of shame and sense of failure that gets attached to ending a long-term relationship or a marriage. And, you know, just that record statistic, about 38% of people say they're happy, says that people are staying in situations on a long-term basis that they're not happy in. There's, you know, under conditions of emotional stagnation and non-fulfillment. So technically, it's easy to leave a marriage. It's not illegal technically, but it's still awfully difficult to do. And people make these trade-offs. They trade stability for unhappiness, and grope around for other ways to kind of close the gap.
Let me give our phone number again. It's 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. We're going to take some calls in a few minutes. We're talking today about modern love. You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I have many, many more questions that we could ask about adultery and marriage, but there's one specific notion that I want to hear both of you address. David Shumway, let me start with you. When you talk about romance and intimacy as discourses of love, as you call them, I think that's what you call them,
yes.
Do you think that they are ideologies? In other words, are they out there operating to blind us to something or force us to ignore something that's also out there?
I think romance often functions that way, because it blinds us to the temporality of love, at least of initial infatuation. It's often used in a way that blinds us to to other things. So many of our popular cultural stories paint love, romantic love, as the sort of most important be-all and end-all of life, and that makes people ignore, it seems to me, lots of other social problems, other aspects of life. So it functions as an ideology in that way, but I don't think it's just an ideology. That is, it also functions in a somewhat different way, and that's why I use the word discourse, because it's not prescriptive, the discourse of romance, completely. It gives us alternatives. I mean, there is the alternative of conceiving it as primarily entailed by adulterous relationships, or there's the vision that connects it to marriage. So within romance there are arguments, and similarly within intimacy there are arguments.
What are the arguments in intimacy? I don't see those as clearly as I do with romance.
Well, the arguments would be over things like, the best example is this, that there's a bias towards marriage in the discourse of intimacy. It privileges monogamy, and yet the basis of the discourse is that marriage is just one relationship among others, and that conceivably any relationship is okay as long as it serves the needs of the people involved. And so that's the basic tension within the discourse of intimacy.
Okay, so the basis of the relationship is not the form, but the content.
That's correct.
All right, Laura Kipnis, what do you think? Do you think that any of these discourses are ideological?
Well, I think the whole conception of what a normal person is these days is tied up with intimacy. You know, I think it is entirely prescriptive, because you know, the discourse of normalcy itself is an incredibly powerful ideological tool. And, you know, if you fall out of kind of contemporary norms of intimacy, you're seen as somehow abnormal, somehow a personal failure. So I think all those ideas around normalcy and what's normal and, you know, what's the good life are quite powerful social tools.
Do you think that... Well, when you say that they're social tools, who's using them? Who's manipulating them? All of us?
Well, you know, all this language that comes up, and I also do think it is prescriptive, you know, language around things like maturity or love, you know, is a quite powerful prescriptive thing. And what it enforces is a certain kind of sense of stability. People are meant to pair up and stay in those pairs on a long-term basis. And so, you know, when desire fails or flags, then mature love should kick in. So all the regulations that surround love and desire, you know, I think, yes, are ideological.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some more about modern love, and we'll take some phone calls. Our number is 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. It's toll-free, again, anywhere in the U.S., so do give us a call if you'd like to join in our conversation. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio.
To Chile in the island of Chiloé, where residents say plans to build a huge bridge to the mainland could threaten their distinctive culture.
Arriving by ferry is like going through a magic door to an island like none that exists anywhere else in Chile or South America.
I'm Steve Kerwood. A bridge too far? Next time on Living on Earth from NPR.
Saturday morning at 6 a.m. on Chicago Public Radio. Chicago Public Radio is supported by Instituto Cervantes, the cultural center of Spain. General and specific language and cultural courses include conversation, grammar, translation, business, legal, and medical Spanish. Fall classes beginning now. Information at Cervantes1.org.
welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and we've been talking today about modern love. Our guests are David Shumway, who is the author of Modern Love, Romance, Intimacy, and the Marriage Crisis. He's joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he is on the faculty of the English Department at Carnegie Mellon University. With us here in Chicago is Laura Kipnis, the author of Against Love, a Polemic. Laura Kipnis is a cultural critic and media studies scholar at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. We're going to take some phone calls, which will give me a chance to relax my tongue and be able to say words more clearly. That'll be good. The number is 1-888-859-1800. Let's take a call from Michael. Hello, Michael. You're on Odyssey.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hello.
I thought you might get to me. We have a divorce rate which is about 3 times higher than most other countries. The European average is around 20%. Ours is 60%. The Europeans approve of affairs. We don't. I think it's pretty obvious that the possibility of having an affair and the occasional doing it actually strengthens marriage. And this business of the impeachment of the president, which comes from the old puritanical background, I mean, the Europeans would laugh at that. So I think we've got it wrong, and we need to loosen up a bit.
Laura Kipnis, what do you think?
There is that theory that adultery is the safety valve that keeps marriages intact and lets them go on. The thing that interests me about adultery is when it's a bit less of a containment mechanism than that and opens up some other kind of possibilities, you know, as a little temporary utopian space where people get to experiment. So, you know, there's the adultery social container model, or there's the adultery as, you know, threat to the social fabric model. So I prefer the latter.
David Shumway, your thoughts. First of all, do you really think it's right to say that Europeans approve of affairs, or just that they're less scandalized by them?
You know, there was a recent survey of attitudes toward monogamy in France, which found them to be identical to American attitudes. So, you know, maybe that this continental attitude is sort of a cliche.
What do you think, David Shumway?
Well, I think that the European conception is usually called the bourgeois marriage might be a good thing if one is concerned mainly about this issue of social stability. If you think that marriage really is still the cornerstone of society, it's the argument in my book that it stopped being that some time ago, and that in fact it's no longer necessary to keep up those pretenses. We have other institutions that have largely replaced the family. In the 19th century and earlier, it certainly was economically and in other respects, it did play that role. So I don't see why we should continue to have marriages that are essentially shells, with people finding their emotional and sexual satisfaction elsewhere on that sort of cliched European model.
One thing I would just add is, you know, it may be that we're in a period where marriage as an institution is just under social transition, partly because it's lost something of its economic function, particularly with women entering the workforce and having financial independence. And, you know, one of the things I've wondered and speculated about is all of this kind of on-the-ground strife and dissatisfaction something of a byproduct because the whole institution is sort of in transition, and all of this public anxiety around marriage in crisis and infidelity of politicians are sort of byproducts of these transitions, and nobody quite knows where this institution is going or whether it has lost its social function.
David Shumway, I want to ask some more about that, but let's get a few more calls in before we do that. Let's talk with Danielle. Hello, Danielle. You're on Odyssey.
Hi.
Hi.
My question was really, you know, or more of a comment / question for Laura. You know, as far as expectations, I mean, my opportunity to change my expectation of going into getting married. You know, I'm getting married next year, and I don't feel that this person is supposed to solve every problem, be everything to me. I mean, I feel that's unrealistic, and I don't know really any of my friends who feel that that person is supposed to be the end-all, be-all, and I don't know. I feel that that maybe gives us a better chance to succeed. I mean, and that doesn't mean that you're not in love or not sharing intimacy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Laura, you were saying that part of why you were interested in this subject is because of the way you see us, you see as a society, putting so much emphasis on the relationship, be it a marriage or some marriage analog, depending on your particular circumstances. But that in a sense, that's a real... that there's a lot riding on that. Say a little bit more about what you meant specifically. Obviously, everybody's got other things in their lives besides their marriage, work, children, which is a not unrelated topic. But what do you mean when you say that everything's hanging on this? All of our satisfactions?
I think one of the questions that both David and I would be interested in is the ways in which expectations of another person or the satisfaction that comes from private life has some sort of relation to larger forms of satisfaction or dissatisfaction. You know, part of this whole thing about the work ethic of love is it comes about at a time when Americans are working longer hours and making less, and other kinds of social benefits are being cut. You know, I think the nation itself at some level isn't delivering on the promises that, you know, it has traditionally, you know, offered to citizens for its fidelity. So what other forms of dissatisfaction or boredom, you know, the conditions of work, for example, you know, which are, you know, it's accepted that jobs can be boring. So there's a way in which I think so much of our desire for happiness and fulfillment gets put back into personal life or on another person because social conditions themselves are anxiety-producing and unsatisfying. So I'm interested in, you know, trying to tie those two spheres together, and they're usually seen as autonomous and separate.
Now, what I would add to that is that it's specifically the increasingly dominant free market economy which is responsible for this. That is, as the market dominates more and more aspects of our lives, the more and more gets thrown back on the couple relationship because our other relationships are attenuated by the fact that they have to be subservient to the market.
Are you saying that marriage or the love relationship becomes it's the one remaining space outside of that, and so it has to do all of the compensating for all the things that are lost in the market?
Exactly right. Okay.
And also, you know, if people feel disempowered socially or politically or on their jobs, you know, does that have a relationship to the kind of control issues that get played out in the couple? You know, the big joke, and jokes, I think, are an incredibly good source of information about these things, about couples, is, you know, the fight for the remote control. And that's a way of, you know, condensing all of these control issues. But does it have something to do with lack of sense of control and empowerment elsewhere, like in work?
It's not just about the fact that it's irritating to have someone clicking the channels past you while you're watching TV.
Maybe it would be less irritating if you were more fulfilled on your job.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Oh, really?
Let's go ahead, David Chavoy.
Well, of course, it's also about the fact that there remain structural gender inequalities that are fought out in relationships, and that's one of the things that I think accounts for much of the current dissatisfaction. That if we had more genuine equality socially, and therefore I think really would be in the relationship itself, I think relationships would work better. And there wouldn't be as many of these power struggles.
Let me give our number again. It's 1-888-859-1800. We're talking today on the program about modern love and the modern concept of the relationship. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Let's take another call. Let's talk with Arturo. Hello, Arturo. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. I just wanted to mention on the getting back to why people try things over and why the way we do this is still the same would be, in my opinion, I see that a lot of us or a lot of people always seem to want to have something to show for their lives in the end of it. Like the you always want to have like the picture of you have your kids, you have your wife, you die, you have these people who carry your memory and something substantial to show for all the time you spent on this planet.
And someone who can do that, someone who can say, you know, I saw you do all those things and I saw your life.
And also I wanted to mention on the sorry, I just froze for a sec, that now that we're living a lot longer, you know, we need to start looking at what is the point of relating to another person on such intimate terms. The way we've come to realize that relationships are based on these rules that were made for people to procreate and fulfill a certain amount of society chores before they die between, you know, 30 to 40.
Mm-hmm.
And back when most of these religions and society ideas came about. Now that we're living longer, we're really just piecemealing what we're doing or what's the point of our relationships in love and marriage, instead of really taking everything all into throwing it all out to the side and saying, what is it that this should be accomplishing now that I am living up to 80,
right.
I am living up to longer than just to make enough money to eat, and am capable of fulfilling or becoming a fully realized person.
Laura Kipnis, let me
for society.
Right. Let me ask you to comment on this, because in the one of the rare moments in your book where you do talk about the benefits of love relationships, it seems to be exactly this satisfaction that you point to, you know, the idea that your partner is almost like your biographer, you know, someone who knows you and can sort of validate your life and your existence.
Right. Well, you know, just remember, Gretchen, I wrote a polemic exactly so I didn't have to say the other's.
I know. You didn't have to make your case.
I got to be irresponsible and raise contentious points. You know, the marriage historian Lawrence Stone makes this kind of hilarious and mordant point about modern divorce that early death, you know, in previous times probably solved the problem of the long-term marriage, and now divorce, the high divorce rate, substitutes for what was once taken care of more efficiently by early death. And there is a question which I think doesn't really get asked. Should relationships last 30 or 40 or 50 years now that lifespans have increased? And, you know, what if desire doesn't last 30 or 40 or 50 years? You know, the presumption is, I guess, that if it doesn't, if you don't have desire anymore for your mate, you're just supposed to give up sex because, you know, looking elsewhere is unethical. So there just isn't a discussion, I think, in any open sense about, you know, what should we be able to expect and what kinds of gratifications come from, you know, these long-term relationships.
We've just got a few minutes left, but let's talk specifically about marriage as a social institution. I mean, you've both talked about this and talked about the notion that is out there that divorce and adultery somehow suggests some sort of crisis in this institution. But you've also suggested the possibility that maybe there's a transition going on. David Shumway, what is your take on marriage and its social role these days?
Well, I think the social role of marriage has been declining for several hundred years now, and it continues to decline, though it remains a fixture in law, so it has a social role. Child rearing is probably the one place where marriage continues to be socially necessary, but we're working on ways, I think, to even reduce that with daycare and other alternatives to parental child rearing. But I see this as potentially liberating because it allows marriage and other relationships, it allows there to be other relationships. We don't have to insist on marriage any longer. That will suit the people involved in them. I'm not naive enough to think that this transition will be easy or that everybody will be made happy by it, but I think it suggests the possibility of happiness for maybe more people than in the past.
David Shumway teaches in the English department at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He is the author of Modern Love, Romance, Intimacy, and the Marriage Crisis. Laura Kipnis, your thoughts on the same question.
Well, the question we didn't actually get to is the gay marriage issue. And the only thing that I would say is it's very interesting that instead of making a political battle out of disaggregating resource questions for marriage, there's this fight for gay marriage. And so obviously it does have some kind of resonance, even among this group who at one point were social renegades, sexual renegades, are now opting for the institutional solution. So I'm not sure I agree with David that, you know, it's lost so much of its social presence. It seems to be, you know, getting renewed, at least in that struggle.
Laura Kipnis is the author of Against Love, A Polemic,
She is a cultural critic and a media studies scholar at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Laura Kipnis and David Shumway, thank you both very much for joining me today.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, James Liris, and welcome aboard to our new intern, Maura Waltz. Our technical producer is Steve Warnauskas. Our program is produced by Allison Cuddy and Delia Lloyd. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. If you'd like to learn more about our program, visit our website at odysseyradio.org. That's O-D-Y-S-S-E-Y radio, all one word, .org. Once you get there, you can listen to this show again. You can also listen to past editions of Odyssey. And we encourage you to sign up for a regular email update letting you know what's coming up each day on Odyssey. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marge Ostruschko. Funding for the program is provided by a generous grant from the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.